So the Olandia here is three weeks long, and one week trying to offer a different, well, I think it's probably a very different vision of what Gemara is and the problem it is too, that will hopefully change the way in which you can look at Gemara, as Gemara. What is the doctrine that you particularly hear enough, there's a change in the beginning of the Olandia school. And then, in the succeeding weeks, we're going to read, first, one week we're going to spend just reading a Sugya according to Rashi, and the second week just reading a Sugya according to Rambam. And we'll see how that mode of analysis affects the way in which we can read Rishonim as well as providing new tools for understanding both Rashi and Rambam. The topic of it is Bayera Bayimasei, and the whole question of what kind of relationship it is forbidden for Jews to have with Chametz on Pesach. But I want to, in order to introduce the methodology, I want to start with an entirely different subject. It will take us about 20 minutes or so to actually get to where they're at. The first thing I want to start with is a thing introducing Dr. Aleph, where you have a mission that says the following. The first says, okay, so there is a category called mitzvot ha-bein al ha'av, which where there is a distinction in that men are chayav and women are not, and there is a category called mitzvot ha'av ha-ben, in which men and women have the same obligation. Okay, now what I gave you then are two figures, which are about four pages apart in the Talmud. Okay, so take a look at them. So, what do you see when you look at these two figures, four pages apart? Identical structure. The only difference is that the steps I call 3 and 6 are inverted in the second sugya. Right? And in fact, in the first sugya, it says bain and then av, and the second sugya says av and then bain. Okay, so let's read through the sugya as a whole. Right? The sugya says, what does it mean when you say mitzvot ha-bein al-av? Line 2. If you were to say, Ilegon, right? Call me tzvot in the chayev berol me'avat lava. If you were to say that it means mitzvot of children towards lava, right? Then that can't be because the breakta is verse number 3 contradicted. How it contradicted is not my issue. So rather, 1-4, Yehuda says, you have to read the phrase mitzvot ha-bein al-av as if it meant Mitzvot of the son, hamusalot halav, which are obligatory on the father, la'atot mitno, to do to his son. Okay, now some of you are raising eyebrows and saying, yeah, that's not possible, right? Mitzvot of the halav obviously means obligations of the children, children towards parents, not obligations of parents, right? They're obligatory on parents to do towards children. That's a wild stretch. Then we say, oh, guess what, line 5, guess what, now that we've reversed it that way, it turns out that the first line of our Mishnah says the same thing as the following verse in number 6. Okay, so that's our structure is, if you want to know what the term, what the line of the Mishnah means, we give what looks like a simple reading of the line, and then we say that contradicts the verse, so we offer a complete reversal of the line, and we say, oh good, now we agree with the verse. Okay, figure number 2. Again, 4 pages apart. If you were to say it means mitzvot of the father towards the son, it contradicts the Brisa. So therefore we offer a complete inversion of the line. And we say, oh good, now we've completely inverted the line, so that means mitzvot of the father that are obligatory on the son to do towards the father. Guess what? It agrees with the Brisa. Okay, now what does this tell us about the nature of Talmud? So here I want to introduce one traditional notion called Darsh Baal Peh. Darsh Baal Peh means that there was a time when other than the written Torah, everything existed in your head. But the issue I want to raise is, what does it mean for a text to exist in your head? Okay, so there is a notion that for text to exist, There's that exists in your head. The one solution is that it just means that everything will be exactly the way it is in Thomas. Just you by heart. And there's nothing changed other than the writing down of the text. But that, I think that would be an error to try and demonstrate what I think it meant to have Talmud in your head. So what I suggest is that you have Talmud in the first place. You have Talmud in your head. What it meant was that they memorized forms. Because right? the whole point of having stuff in your, when you have stuff in your head, what you need is maximum efficiency. What you need basically is a compression algorithm. The Talmud was designed as a compression algorithm that would let people keep as much information in their head as possible. And the way you did that was that you had specific forms that would write, and then you could just have a title sentence, right, and a form, and you could reconstruct that. You could reconstruct the title sentence into the form. So here, what happened was that everyone knew there was this Mishnah, and there was a form which was asking what does the Mishnah mean? Havamina, rejected by Baisa, rereading, now it agrees. Now you could reconstruct that form from either the first line or the second line. And you ended up with two identical sugyos, right? It's not like two independently evolving sugyos. This is just the way in which people reconstructed it out of their heads when they knew that this was the form. That this was the form that generated the figure. Okay, that's page one, is to just understand that the purpose of Talmud, I think much of Talmud becomes much, much clearer when you think that when you recognize that the language of Talmud is still largely oral. It's still largely oral, meaning it's still largely an attempt to write down the way it exists in your head as opposed to a literary document. And many of the features of Talmud are there because it was much easier to memorize it. That's why you like the symmetry. That's why you always use the same language all the way through, even when the language means different things. All sorts of issues like that. Yes, sir.
Writing mind-confusing
matter
better than just
letting
straight out,
No, we'll get to that a little bit. I'm going to get there. Right now, I'm just interested in the form of the figure. Okay, that's all I'm interested in right now, the form of the figure. And you have to understand, at least my theory is, that what existed in your head was just this Mishnah and then that structure. And your job was to reconstruct it. And it got written down, they reconstructed it both ways. Okay. Second point is that, this is a point I'm done already. You can look at Don and see if he's saying the exact same thing as I am later. I don't think he is, but close enough. Do either of these figures exist independently? Let's suppose I reread the first line, Kol Mitzvot Avos Aben Al Av. Now that means all mitzvot that parents have for children. That's what the line means now, right? So the first line now reads, all mitzvot that parents for children, men are obligated when they're not. Now I read the second line, unmodified. So that means all mitzvot of parents for children, men when they're equal to parents. That's equal here. So in point of fact, you can't have one figure without the other. Right? The two figures are mutually dependent. Right? Because if you reverse the first line, you have to reverse the second line. If you reverse the second line, you reverse the first line, otherwise the text becomes incoherent. So you recognize that actually, and furthermore, it turns out to be coincidentally enough the same person. The same person who reverses both figures. I'm going to read it, I'll take exactly the same way. So, what I wanted to then go further is that there's two stages. One stage is to recognize that the way in which the Talmud existed in people's heads as a text was as a topic and a form. And the second thing is to recognize that the form is not the same thing as the thought. The form is a way, when you know what you're supposed to be saying, and then you try to figure out what form was the most efficient way of converting that into text. But really, what existed in people's heads originally, the thought process was, oh look, here's a Mishnah, here are two brachos. The only way to make the Mishnah reconcile those two brachos is to reverse the Mishnah.
Yeah.
So where the brake is?
It sounds like, so if what people carry in their head, whatever, like film, is a bit metaphorical, then it also sounds like it was not necessarily guaranteed that the answer would come out in a certain way.
No. So there are two radically opposed. Like, you know, if you sit in yeshiva, you'll get one version of a Talmud as usual. If you sit in university, you'll get another version. The version you'll get in what yeshiva is, the Talmud is the record of the conversation. The version you'll get in most universities is the Talmud is something that people sitting down much later wrote down and enclosed in the text. Right? The first one doesn't account for what the text is, which is not a live conversation. It doesn't look chronologically that way, it doesn't look literally that way. The second doesn't account for tradition. Right? So what I argue is that you always have a live tradition. The live tradition is reduced to writing at a particular point. What they had in their heads is the Mishnah and the form which embodies the traditional relationship of the Mishnah to other texts. When you can memorize it, right, rather than memorizing it as a really long document, right, they found ways of encoding that. Right? You know, I think, you know, beneath it was very useful to understand what impression of it is in picture you are, right? There's just ways in which you use less information so you can write, and you have ways of recovering in your head. Yes, ma'am.
Why would you require it in the copy? How do you reject it as part of the form? Why not simply have, what do you go from line 1 to line 4?
So you have to understand why. Otherwise it just looks like a radical reinterpretation. There's no purpose for it. Part of the information you're encoding is that the reason you interpret the mission of this way is to make it reconcile with the process. Okay, now I should also point out that efficiency is very much become like all language, right? So language is a combination of efficiency and redundancy, right? Because you have to put the term out of redundancy to prevent error. And I don't have a really sophisticated mathematical framework for it. It's something that's capable of doing that. I'm more than welcome to figure out if there's a ratio that they figure out. This was supposed to be my doctorate, who was recovering the oral Talmud and figuring out, and one of the things that you show is that certain types of forms are more susceptible to error than other types, and different kinds of error, and that's why you can track how certain kinds of acknowledged confusion in the Talmud only occur in certain errors and certain yeshivas. Like who said what is a product of largely of the Chalamar form, where at some point it turned out to be reversed. The names got reversed too often if you lost track of who said what. It was presumably originally it was an A-B-A-B form, but it just got reversed too easily if you kept on forgetting who said what. Things like that are the evidence, the clearest evidence of memorizing by form is something called Ikadamatni, which is, ikonomotomy is when they walk the context of a statement, but if you look in the Talmud, you'll see that they will reconstruct figures of identical forms with entirely different topics. And present them as alternatives. Because there was a statement which applied to some context, but they didn't remember which context, but they remembered the form. And so then they would try their best to recover the form for each, right, recover the form for each context. Okay. So this is my first move, if I want to. I want to say that when one is looking at Talmud, so it is at least one perspective, not the only one, and we'll see different ones in Rashi and Rambam, but one way to understand is to try and, first of all, understand how this text is produced by a form, which it almost always will be, and secondly, to recognize that form is an encoding of a prior, or of a prior set of information. And so really, you can try and figure out what was the prior set of information that this text is trying to encode. Yes.
That helps
guide lean
towards the academic model of
it's written later. But the academic model is that the content is simultaneous with the writing. And I'm not able to know, right? The writing is just the attempt to reduce, to reduce it. So I'm going to give you one other metaphor, which will to try and explain. This will be very, very valuable next week. I'll try to explain why is it that these two figures are 4 pages apart. Obviously, they're connected together. They're the same figure, right? How are they 4 pages apart? So the answer to that is to think that in when you're going to why do we have all these attempts at what we call a snuff out? Right, the attempts to connect so much of search software to search the stuff. So you can have a religious notion that some people think that the whole purpose of Samsara is to connect search to stuff and search software. Very nice. But I think that's pedagogically. Pedagogically, if you can find a way to have the text of Torah be in mind for all search software, that means the Kriya Torah all year and it will be to review all Torah. Right, so the goal is to construct a, right, the goal is to construct a mnemonic, right, to make the Torah a giant mnemonic, so that every time you hear Torah, you review, and eventually you have this really efficient thing, one short text, right, Torah, which lets you have the entire fall of Judaism in your head. That's right. That's the purpose of the Osmosis. Now, so what needs to be understood is that the oral Torah is always conceived of as text interpretation, and you're always supposed to be expanding from text, right, from text to interpretation. So what you have here is a line in the Mishnah, probably called a Vanarav, and you're supposed to see through that line. It's a three-dimensional property. On top is the Mishnah, and if you see through it, you'll see that in the first line there is this, and the second line, there is this. But what happens is, there's a lot of information in the first line. And so we have to take this three-dimensional text and flatten it into a two-dimensional text. So in the same way as the globe turns into a map. Things that are really close together, all of a sudden lots of things apart with them because they're supposed to be lined up on a single axis. Right? But really, they're flattened, and so things end up really, really far apart. Of course these two together are supposed to be next to each other. They go to your head. They're both generated directly by the text. But on paper, all the other things that are generated by the text come in between them. Okay? That's how you get something four pages apart that is really organic. Okay. With that in mind, I need one more thing out of this video, and then I'll turn to cover. The last thing I want to get out of to figure out what the alternative is to Rabbi Lewis and Ambitious. I'm asking, we have a Mishnah which says Thomas Bonavan Al really means mitzvot of sons towards fathers, and Thomas Bonavan Ben really means mitzvot of fathers towards sons. Okay, so I want to take a look at the bottom of the first page, and you'll see there's two chapters. The chapter says the following. Edo mitzvot ha-ben al-ha-al, nafil ha-mashker ha-vishum tafeh, nafis ha-mosi, nafis ha-sanar yadav ragoav, edo mitzvot al-ha-ben, l'mulo v'lot v'shtotel. Okay, so what are the mitzvot of ha-ben al-ha-al? And these are obviously obligations of children towards parents. Right. So to set the read ha-ben al-ha-al as meaning what we would expect it to mean. Okay, either before all the Ben, Lamulov, Miskoso, etc. Okay, so the question is, does this disprove Rabbi Yehuda? Do we say that Rabbi Yehuda is wrong because we have a parallel text which has the words meaning the opposite? Now here's the way I want to complicate that question. If Rabbi Yehuda is wrong, does the halacha change? Do women all of a sudden become, right, do we say that the Mishnah really means that women are obligated to circumcise and be so their sons, and that daughters are not obligated to feed their parents? Absolutely right. Halakhah is given, which means that in our sugyot, the brachos are given. The brachos which establish the halakha are given. The alternative to Rabbi Yehuda's rereading of the Mishnah is to amend the Mishnah. Right? As everyone knows what the Mishnah has to mean. The only question is, can you get the Mishnah to mean that without changing the words? Or do you have to change the words? So he just came up with this, apparently while reading, which enabled you to preserve the text. Everybody already memorized, and he always had a strong interest in not changing the text, because the text was in people's heads. And it's much easier to get people to change their understanding of what they already memorized than to get them to have to re-memorize. Because once you re-memorize, you know, you always tell your teacher, once you get the wrong answer out there, well, you put the say, and once it's in your head, you have to memorize one way, and then you have to memorize it in reverse, and never remember which one's right. Right, so it's much better to leave the text as it is. Now, Yehuda came up with a way of preserving the existing text without losing the meaning. Because the meaning was impossible. Everyone knew what the meaning had to be. And it was always very important to figure out when you were debating interpretation, whether what you're debating is what does the text mean, or you're debating is what should we do. Right, those are very different. Those are very different conversations. Very different. With very different. Very different intermediate points. And it's very important in order to understand these problems to go, to understand which one we are engaged in. And you just have to guess it. I think that you always have to ask this question when we are, particularly when we are offering what seems to be forced reading. Right. Are they generated forced readings? Right. Are we reading them because we want to reach a new result? Right. Or are they simply, or we know what the result is and we're just trying to find a way to fit the existing data into it? Right. Another way of saying, say, in when you're learning Chumash, there are things that we might claim that this is the Midrash Halakha and that's not there. Right. It's not quite true because often we know what, you know, often we'll come with a Midrash Halakha. It'll be called Midrash Halakha, even though we know what the answer has to be. So it's not, right, I'm not going to, but that notion, that some interpretations get you to pre-programmed results, and some interpretations get new results, and you have to know which one you're doing. It's a very important distinction. Okay, so those are my broad comments for how to approach Talmud. What I want to do for the rest of today is to try and teach you a very complicated sugya without looking at it at all. Go back to the first rest of the notion that to see if we can recover what it was like to have to understand Talmud even before you crystallize it in form. Right? If we can try and think like the rabbis who created the form. Okay, in other weeks we'll talk about what it means to understand the form. Right, and how Rashi, right, and how Rashi and Rambam addressed that in some ways. But right now I want to try and take what looks like a very, very complicated figure. And if you follow it the way it's written, it's a very, very complicated, it's a very, very complicated figure. And suggest that at least it's a little bit simpler. Not still complicated. But it's a little bit simpler if you can try and figure out what it was like before it was written down. Now, you'll have to point out that once the text is written down, so then obviously form has significance also. There are choices involved. And I'll give you a metaphor from Tanakh. One of my favorite moments in Tanakh is how does a sailor in the book of Jonah find out that Jonah is running away from God? No? Before they found the water. No? No, that's how they find out it's because of him. So how do they find out that he's running away from God? He tells them. Very good. He tells them. Right? So if you can imagine, right, the way it's right. So now we know, right? Now in the story of the book of Yonah, right, this is the information. The story of the book of Yonah, the sailors find out that Yonah is running away from God because he tells them. But it makes a huge difference. And the version is as follows. Right? Here's a straightforward version. So the sailors said, Who are you? Where are you from? What work do you do? And Yonah says, I am a Jew, and I fear the God of heaven and earth. And that's not a question. You know, really answer that question. And they say, and gee, why is there this storm? And Yonah says, there's this storm because I'm running away from God. And then their obvious next question is, why are you running away from God? And he says, I'm running away from God because I'm going into it, right? And right, God told me to destroy Nineveh, right? And then, what the text actually says is, it says, who are you? Where are you coming from? What's your work? And Jonah says, I am a Jew. And I am a Jew and I fear the God of heaven and earth. And the sailors were very afraid, because they knew he was running away from God because he had told them. Now, it was like one of the fascinating powers of the very moment is where you can see that form matters, is that the text goes out of its way not just to make sure that you don't get to see the honest conversation with the sailors, but to make sure that you know you're not getting the honest conversation with the sailors. That's the critical moment you're spending. Yes? They give the outcome of the sailors understand it.
Right.
But. So if you, this is a separate thing. My sharing Sefer Yonah is all predicated on the notion that the key literary phenomenon of Sefer Yonah is that you never, is that you don't get to find out why Yonah runs away until after the poem. That's an example where I could teach you the plot, and it's very important to understand the plot, right? But it's also very important to take account of how the plot is encoded in language. So I'm not claiming right now that I'm teaching you the sugya in a way that you no longer have to read the sugya. Right? There are lots of things important about form, but I think that it's helpful often to try and look back and say what's going on in the sugya and what's going on in the sugya, and then I can ask the question, why did they choose to write it down this way? Okay, so I'll give you the exactly parallel case. If you look at this, the next page, which is a really long sugya, So if you look, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the bottom. You'll see it says Lokashya, and if you want to get Lokashya. Lokashya, Hadu Amar Lein Asher, right? One is a case where you said the words Me'ashav, and one is a case, you don't care what the words mean right now. One is a case where you said the words are not Me'ashav. After which the Gemara says, Umidat Tehra, the Shayyuan, the Hebed Amar, Me'ashav, they hate longer Me'ashav. Gee, how did you know you were supposed to say that? And it turns out there's a breakdown. Now, obviously, the editors of the sugya knew the breakdown. They made a choice. It's not like, again, if it's a live conversation, and they can say, oh, they made this distinction, which seems to have no basis at all, and somebody said, hey, where'd that come from? And somebody else came in and said, oh, right, I know, I can find a basis for that. But if you think of this as a literary construction, then the question is, why did they choose to hold that brisa, which gave you that information, until after they introduced the distinction as opposed to before? Right, same type of issue. Okay. Let's take a look at the sugya itself. Okay, so the sugya, right, so the first line of the text is an issue that you can see is very, very similar to the mission we just did. Right, there's two parallel cases where the parties are reversed between line A and line B, and therefore the outcomes are different between line A and line B. Right, so line one is, if a non-Jew lends money to a Jew with the Jew's coming as collateral, right, then the halacha is that the chametz is permitted after Pesach. Whereas if a Jew lends money to a non-Jew, the non-Jew's chametz is collateral, then the chametz is forbidden after Pesach. Okay, so very straightforward reading of this. This is a beautifully symmetrical notion, and you have a single principle that should explain it, which is, what is the point at which what we will call for now ownership moves between Jew and non-Jew? Right, the consistent position that there is something called giving chametz as collateral, that involves a transfer of ownership from one party to another. Okay, very straightforward. That's what we just had to mention. Okay, so you see this, it could probably take a long, long time discussing it, right? Because it's all so good. It's about that, and I even cut off one of the tangents. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to show you, to turn to the next page, I want to go through a series of reducing the information in this text. So I have, this page is all the 10 egg information in this figure. Okay, now again, back in the to give you this, but again, they will teach you in the Shidot, which has a certain amount of truth to it, is that it's very important to distinguish between Mishnah Yod and Breitza. Right, because the Mishnah is a really authoritative text, and the Breitza is the stuff that didn't make the interview, not that didn't edit it. Now, we showed you the first thing is you have to be careful because, well, it's true, the Mishnah is the most authoritative text. What that means is you have to make sure that you understand the Mishnah in the way that agrees with Halakha. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to understand Halakha in the way that agrees with the Mishnah. Right, so it doesn't mean the text, the authoritative text has to encode the Halakha. It doesn't mean it generates Halakha. So when you have a conflict between Mishnayot and Braytos, it doesn't mean that you always reinterpret the Braytos to match the Mishnah. It just means that you interpret the Mishnah, and you always end up with the Mishnah as much as possible in agreeing with the Halakha. For example, Professor Gaffney, the academic, Professor Gaffney argues that many of the apparently wildly interpretations of Mishnayot are the result that is that the Mishnah actually encodes the Israel Halakha, and that it became authoritative in Babel. So you have to find a way in Babel to understand the text in the way which agrees with Babel and Babel and Halakha. That might be. It's an interesting case to explain certain reinterpretations. I think it's simpler to say that with the sole exception of the occasional explicit statement, why did you prefer to ask this question from the Mishnah rather than the Braita? There is absolutely no difference between Mishnah and Braita to the problem. There's no difference in authority, there's simply no difference. It's the Halakha, how we talk it, ends up. So that's, it's a result of the presumption that the Mishnah has to agree with Halakha. Not because we reject Braita in the face of the Mishnah or vice versa. I'm going to defend that thesis that you, that in 99% of the time you'll not be able to tell any sugya, which is a Mishnah, which is a Braita, from an authority perspective. Okay, given that, so we have in this sugya our three Braita. If you go back to the sugya, you'll see that I bolded everything that was 10 8 and underlined everything that was over 8. But now we're just going to deal with 10 8 gathers. I mean, here's what the three Braita says. So the Braita 1 says, Nafri Shilva Yisrael Ochemso, Akara Petat Mutrabana, Yisrael Shilva, Nafri Ochemso, Akara Petat Mutrabana. Okay, so I'm dividing that Braita into case A, which is case A is where the Gentile is the lender and the Jew is the borrower, and case B is where the Jew is the lender and the Gentile is the borrower. Okay, I mean, the second Braita, right, so Yisrael Shilva Nafri Ochemso, Akara Petat Ochemso there, but we should be there on their rule there. But I will not be Shabbat Yisrael can tell the Akhara sets up the Be'er Kabul Be'er. And there's a third Raita, which says, not be Shiri and Pat Karani, so Yisrael, you know there, you know my body, you got see Kabul Be'er. Okay, these are three Raita, all which address the question of certain types of context in which there is a loan transaction with collateral, and one part is a Jew, one part is a non-Jew. Okay, what happens if we line them up? And you take all the cases where the Jew is the lender and the Gentile is the borrower, and you line them up and see what the outcomes are. And we take all the cases where the Gentile is the lender and the Jew is the borrower, and we line them up. Okay, and this is of course what people in the Beit Midrash did. Okay, so here's what happens. This is what the Rome number will do. In the case where the Gentile is the lender, so in the first, in our Mishnah, right, for text 1, the outcome is Achara Pesach Mutar B'Hana'a. Right, everyone agrees that your covenant is fine. Gentile lends the money, Jewish covenant is collateral, we're fine. In the first Braita, the outcome is, everyone agrees, right, Dibri HaKol, everyone agrees, it's forbidden. Uh-oh. Okay. What about the other case? With the other case, where the Jew is the lender and the non-Jew is the borrower. So we have our Mishnah, which says it's forbidden. We have the Braita, which says it's a machloket. And we have the second Braita, which says it's a tenth. Okay? I boil that down to Roman numeral 3. Right, and Roman numeral 3, so you can see that you can see how the above that very straightforwardly, right? In case A, the two options are Mutar and Asur. In case B, the three options are Asur, Machloket, and Tawi. Yes. Yeah. That's right. So this only, right, yes. This, so now, now we have to, granted that now we understand that the Tanakhic evidence is, right, it's fully contradictory. Right, now we have to figure out what are our assumptions, where we want to get to.
Okay, so now you're going to introduce, I'm going to introduce an assumption which I think is a legitimate, although not absolutely a assumption, which is that if we have conflicting texts without names associated with them, and no tradition that there is a dispute, we prefer to reconcile them. Okay, right, that's a presumption that we don't create this, right, that the tradition has ways of encoding disputes. And right, so if we have no tradition of a dispute, we presume that all the texts are reconcilable. Doesn't always work. Right, but that's our presumption. Okay. So the first formal move we make is to say, well, you know what? Let's take a look at case A. Case A has two options, forbidden and permitted, and case B has at least one person who holds forbidden in one case and permitted in the other. Okay, then there's one anomaly, which is one person who holds forbidden in both cases. Right, we'll get there, right? But that person is a problem. He's going to break symmetry. Everybody else is working with symmetry. Now we have the third breaker, which tells us it depends. So the easiest way to resolve the apparent conflict between the text is to say that text A is dealing with case one of its depends, and case B is dealing with case two of its depends. Okay, so the end, and that's where we get to Roman numeral 4. Right, Roman numeral 4. What we do is we redistribute the second breakfast. And if you have mathematical, framework. So we say that, right, that the brisa, right, that the last brisa, the Frisha Hirin Tani Israel, says essentially that if you don't say Hikatis, that so in the case where the Gentile is the lender and the Jew is the borrower, if you don't say Hikatis, then the money the case of the Gentile is the borrower, the Jew is the lender, right? The non-Jew who gives his money as collateral to the Jew. Right? So the text says that if you don't say higatita, then the chametz still belongs to the non-Jew. And if you say higatita, then the money belongs, then the chametz belongs to the Jew. So let's just distribute that. And so we'll say that our Mishnah, which says that the collateral belongs to the lender, is talking about a case where you say higatita. And the brisa, which says that the collateral remains in the hands of the borrower, right, it's not in the case of lo higatecha. Okay, so that's where, right, so at the end of number 4, right, we now have an explanation of all the tenuous evidence except for the position that breaks symmetry. If we were to work on the simple principle ownership versus non-ownership, right, both texts agree that principle ownership versus non-ownership, and everyone agrees that the moment at which ownership is transferred from the borrower to the lender is if you say higatita, and if you don't say higatita, then the ownership is not transferred. Okay, that's the what we don't have at this point is an explanation of why Rabbi Meir seems to think that it's forbidden no matter what. Yes?
Are we going to talk about why they just put it up in the series on Mishnah, which was explained, which would mean you don't have to go through it?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that when it's put in, I mean, the question is, is it obvious or not? You know that outcome or not. We don't have a wise vision, we're just trying to figure out the text. They may have thought it was perfectly obvious. Now, shouldn't the bright said, well, we got these, but yeah, okay. But you can't put it every fashion, you know, every fashion every day. I recognize it's matter of the mission as part of the self-decision collection. And the bright that are not, the obligation information are different. It may be that actually what we call bright to 3 is just a continuation of bright to 2, and then everything works out. But you have to say what you got to say and make it explicit. I'm not too demonstrating that, I just think that it's a possibility. Okay. So what we move then to is to figure out whether
whether the Amoraic information will help us at all in figuring out how to explain the signature. Okay, so it turns out that in this figure, right now in that in this figure, I gave you the three Sinaitic texts, right, again lined up. The first text is now the Higatika, the second text is about Lo Higatika, and the third text is about one case the other way. Now let's look at what the Amoraic evidence is. So we have a statement of Rabbi Yitzchak. Yitzchak says the following. How do we know that a creditor actually, the lender, acquires the collateral? Okay, now, we call the lender acquiring the collateral. So it's coming from, he says the answer is in the phrase of Lepatiyat Zakah. So here's the case
is you're the rich lender, you're taking collateral from the poor borrower. So the question is, do you give him back his collateral when he needs it? Right, so we have this fun case where he gives you his pajamas as collateral during the day and his work clothes as collateral during the night. And that's the tzedakah for you. But if you don't own them, what's the tzedakah? You're not right to it. Okay, so Yitzchak takes the position that the fact that we call it a tzedakah to allow the person their own goods tells you that in fact the lender owns the mashkan when from the moment of the loan. Okay?
So now we're going to be simplistic and say, we're going to talk about the claim that it's a tzedakah to you not to give it back to him has to be at the point at which you already acquire it. And that's during the term of the loan. If you look at Tamash, it's done during the term of the loan. So it has to be a case for the collateral. The collateral is at least present initially. Okay. So Rabbi Yitzchak takes the position that a mashkan belongs to the lender at the moment of the loan. Okay, now we have thus far avoided any addressing the question of what constitutes ownership. I'm not here to risk stuff here. And I'm not planning to this to talk about what ownership means. So obviously, what I've just been saying is, for our purposes, we can assume there is a single principle called ownership that we can define at some later point. Okay, now Yitzchak comes along and he claims that actually ownership is transferred to the lender at the moment of the loan. So the problem is going to be, of course, that if that's the case, then there shouldn't be any controversy who owns the chametz. If it's a single principle, which is ownership, we have a broad statement of ownership. So obviously, we just line up with the case in which the halacha is that the chametz belongs to the lender, not to the borrower. Right? We're talking about a case of higatichas. Okay, we're home, right? We're home free. We don't have any problems now. We do have the second Amoraic issue, which says, Balfo, Abai Yomar Lavafreya who go there, the Rabba Arami Kano Lavafu, Mikano Lavafu go there. Right, Abai says that the creditor acquires the collateral at the moment of the loan, and Rabba says he only acquires the collateral at the moment of default. Now the question is, do we want Abaye and Rabbah to be disagreeing with Rabbi Yitzchak and saying, well, Yitzchak really Abaye agrees with Rabbi Yitzchak, but Rabbah disagrees? Or it really should be Abaye and Rabbi Yitzchak against Rabbah or not?
So there are a couple of reasons we don't want to do that. One is your base click has a plus hook, and there aren't any, there aren't an alternative reading of the plus hook. Secondly, we don't have a tradition that there is a dispute about that. Right? It's more likely to have a tradition that there is not, that there are dynasties. And we have a great way of distinguishing. Because all we can say is, oh look, Abai and Nova are arguing about Logikatika. And Rabbi Yitzchak already put Negatika. So now Abai and Rava and Abai and Rava and Rabbi Yitzchak aren't arguing at all. Rabbi Yitzchak gives the case of our Mishnah, which says that it always belongs to the lender. And Abai and Rava are the case of the Braita. And look, in the Braita there is a Machlokas. And Abai and Rava disagree. So everything is beautifully lined up. If we're happy, if we're happy saying that an Amoraic dispute recreates a Canaanite dispute. And that is something that we should always have been disclosing on. Right? Sometimes Kitanoi is a happy solution, and sometimes Lenin Kitanoi is an attack. Right? So at this point we're perfectly happy if we're comfortable with that, but it turns out we're not actually, there's another reason we're not happy with it. Abai and Rava are happy to dispute about ownership per se. Right? When does ownership transfer? That principle, when does ownership transfer, looks like it should be symmetrical. It should apply the exact same way, whether the Jew is the lender or the Jew is the borrower. But the dispute between the Rinair and the Chachamim is not symmetrical. They only dispute the case where the Jew is the lender. They don't dispute the case of the Jew as the borrower. So we have two reasons that we don't actually want these not. We don't actually want these not locus to line up. So what we do is, first we distinguish them, and we say they're talking about different cases. And do that, we say, oh look, we go look at Braita number two, right? So Braita which is dependent. You'll see it begins as opposed to the first two, we're still on top of the third page, the last of the fourth page, right? So the Mishnah says Nafri Shehuva, and the Braita says Yisrael Shehuva. The second Braita says Nafri Shehirhim. So now we have another axis along which we can distinguish, which is the difference between being Malveh, or in Malveh, and being Mahim. Right? And so we end up saying, no, you know what? So the Ta'irik dispute is talking about explicitly, right? It's talking about a case of Hirhim, it's talking about a case where not only did you put the Chametz up as collateral, but you transferred the Chametz to the other person's house. And the Amoraic dispute is talking about a case where you have not transferred the Chametz to the person's house. Okay, so now we distinguish that action. We distinguish that as well, and we're perfectly comfortable. By and other, they have their arguments all they want, and there's no impact on the Chinese discussion. What we're left with now is the only thing they have to explain is the asymmetry. We're still left trying to figure out how is it that Rabbi Meir can take the position that when the Jew is the lender and the Gentile is the borrower, the chametz belongs to the lender. But when the Gentile is the lender and the Jew is the borrower, the chametz belongs to the borrower. Okay, or so far we haven't done any way of doing that. So in order to do that, we have to look at the one factor that has not yet been mentioned in the congregation, which is, if there is difference between inter-religious transactions and intra-religious transactions. Right, and so what the Talmud ends up doing is claiming that now we've identified that the
second verse, which is where the dispute is talking about a case where you put it in the person's house and you said you get this up. We can now see, and guess what? There is a person who says that a Gentile requires possession in such a case, and that person of the mayor. Believes that such a in that case.
So that you can leave in the case. So the breach of symmetry is that the laws of acquiring collateral, right? Oh, acquiring the collateral of loans, those laws are not the same right, an interreligious, interreligious thing, then we can create an asymmetry rate that there are situations in which the Jew acquired the Gentile's object, but the Gentile did not acquire the Jew's object. Yes?
Maybe you have the knowledge that
so here, the Abai and Rava are not talking about Tamei at all.
Mm-hmm.
Abai and Rava have a dispute about loan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what the Talmud does is say, oh look, here's a dispute about loan, please read it. Look, you might be tempted to say the dispute about Tamei parallels the dispute on loan. If you just had the Mishnah, you would make that work. But because we've already gone through the Mishnah and the Brisa, then we know that actually it can't be that simple, because we know there's a case of focus symmetry. Therefore, we're going to claim that they're entirely irrelevant, and the issue, right, and the issue is an narrow issue. Okay, yes?
Try to contrast loan to
Mishnah. Yeah. So it turns out that, yeah, the loan and collateral becomes very much like a sale. But that brings us to the last point, and I think we're actually right on schedule.
So we have now an explanation of the sugya that's imperative. Right? And we know what happened, and that is that they have to reconcile the Tanaic test, they have to reconcile the Amoraic test. They have to find a way in which the Amoraic texts were not subject to the Hanukkah dispute, and they ended up with the resolution to that.
If we go back to the sugya, which we're not trying to do today, but it takes way too long, we'll see that all this happens in an entirely different order. But one of the most interesting things about the sugya is that when the sugya presents initially the dispute between Abai and Rava, alright, says, Abai Amar the very beginning of the sugya. Yeah. Says, and guess what? Abai and Rava are arguing about a peculiar case. Abai Amar is the true case of what happens if somebody tries to sell the collateral during the period of long before the fall. Okay, that's what Abai and Rava are arguing about. Now, this sugya taking place in the Kesef Tzachim, right, why do they have to claim? Just claim whatever the argument of Abai and Rava turns out to be, let's say turns out as we say in the end, that the Machlokes of Abai and Rava is talking about a case where you didn't say he got pizza and you didn't put it in his house. Right, why don't we just say that the Machlokes of Abai and Rava turns out is about who violates by not by Monday, and then it's two Jews that transaction. And why do they have to move on for combinations about sales and hectares? Why don't we just make it about them? Now, more than that, the guard is pointing out that the case the Gemara presents for Abai and Rava, you know what they're really arguing about? Is it right that the reason that we have to narrow the case down because there's an asymmetry there too? Which is that the Naftimina in the Machlokes of Abai and Rava is if one person tries to sell it, but it turns out that there's no argument if the borrower tries to sell it. Everyone agrees the borrower tries to sell it, even though. The only question is, if the lender tries to sell it, does he own it or not? That Abai and Rava disputed about. So there's a broken symmetry, even the Machlokes of Abai and Rava, even in the case of Gemara Gifu. It turns out that you can't go straight from Abai and Rava to the question of who owns it.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh no, wait 1 minute. Okay, so I just want to, even right now, again, I'm working with, that's why it's your symmetry and asymmetry axis, right? So the Gemara tells you that the time of Abai and Rava, you can't even get to a normal case of ownership. Yeah, right, because in fact, saying that X owns the family, X does not own the family, does not mean that Y owns the family. And presumably, if you say that Y owns the family, does not mean that X does not own the family. Okay, so maybe the reason Gemara doesn't say that about Abai and Rava is talking about family is that whereas at least in the case of sales, they found the case of inviting leverage directly correlate with the outcome of ownership and ownership, that it should get from one borrower tries to sell it. In the case of companies, there's no correlation at all. Because it turns out that the concept of the relationship that one is forbidden or permitted to have the summit, on PETA is entirely different than the commercial relationship. And, but this is what introduced to it next week, so the last factor we brought in was the question of whether the company is in some, whether you transfer the collateral to somebody's house or not. So what happens is, in terms of summit, the prohibition is not an issue of title, right, but an issue of possession, control, faith. But then it turns out the majority of buyer rather in fact has absolutely nothing to do with summit, because that's a disputed right, that is generally disputed about commercial ownership. And it turns out the issue of summit, even though we began by saying there's just one sentence, there's just one aspect, which is ownership versus non-ownership, it turns out, if you understand the form of the figure, that ownership and non-ownership is not the correct category at all. Okay, so what we do next week is start with the Sukkim, go through the Gash Halakha, and see if we can develop what the category is, which defines Jewish relationship to Kamehameha, and we'll see how does Midrash Halakha develop a conception which the Gemara here is being extremely careful about, even though it never mentions it explicitly. All right, thank you very, very much.